Thanks for listening to this FX Guide podcast. We're at Autodesk Media and Entertainment with Mark Petit, who is Vice President of Product Development and Operations. So Mark, it's been several months since NAB, which was obviously a big show for you with the new Autodesk name, the introduction of Toxic on the show floor, the acquisition of Colorfront and such. You've had time to reflect. How was the show?
Well, it was an amazing show. I think we've seen it on all the metrics that we use, from a number of orders taken, numbers of leads, number of attendees, but also the feedback of the people. So, you know, it was our first show under our new name, so it was a big event for us, and I think it went well. I mean, we've seen the emotional reaction that we were expected, but I think a lot of people understand the rationale behind it. Not everybody's happy about it, but no, I think it was that message got conveyed pretty easily. But we were happy to see that, you know, the technology got the attention, and Toxic got a very, very interesting reaction. To be honest, we did not expect it, because we thought that, you know, the usual discrete tools have a lot more, discrete system has a lot more tools than that, so it's a 1.0. It's a very focused tool set, but I was amazed that people could see through that and could actually see the power of the underlying infrastructure, the collaboration. We have seen some good traction since the show. It's a pretty novel approach to working, so we see a lot of people wrapping their heads around it. But I think we expect the adoptions not to be too fast, but we're really tracking well. We've got first concrete orders coming in, and it's really going well.
I know that Toxic is intended to be a tool for film pipelines, but I see a lot of potential use for that product in, say, a TV commercial post environment. Any reactions to its use in that way on the show floor?
Yeah, we've got a lot of interest from the post-production community. Our analysis, the initial tool set, because you have to make a decision to get the product out of the door, especially after some years. And the current feature set is really geared towards the film people. And the film compositing, which is highly collaborative and is geared towards very specific functions. Once we round up the tool set, and so it's obviously going to be a product of interest to the post-production community, as you know, surroundings, those flames and those inferno. You know, we like to think of them as hero systems with those stations. So lots of interest. It will take some time to get there. We need first also to get the heroes to work in HDR. So that's why we hinted at that during the user group. So there is a whole logic behind it to come up, both in film and in post-production, with a comprehensive environment that has the flames, the flame kind of system, the Toxic kind of system, as well as all the underlying infrastructure.
One of the issues right now with Toxic is the need to buy multiple seats and hook it into the database and a permanent server. So an artist can't really try it out or test it without a pretty major facility investment. There was talk of a standalone version. Are you still planning on doing this?
Yes, definitely. In the initial version, we really wanted to emphasize the collaborative aspect, which is different. So that's why we stayed away from a standalone, more traditional version. But we'll get there. One of the ideas as well that we're starting to work against is the notion of mobility and enabling either individuals on their own to do design work, or enabling people on set to start to do to test ideas, to capture some work. So a standalone version of Toxic makes sense for an individual, but also makes sense that you would take it on a high performance laptop to the set, just like we showed with Luster on the PowerBook, and you know, starts doing work using all these technologies we know about, FireWire drives, or it's easy to get the data into those laptops. And of course, there are many artists out there that could use it. So we have a whole, you know, multi-year rollout plans in our minds. But what was very important for us this year, our objective was to establish the value of collaboration and establish the robustness of the underlying processing pipeline in HDR. And now we're in the process of declining it along different axes. And so it's the paint system is in development, a bunch of new platforms in development as well. And, you know, so we have a good investment into Toxic, and we expect a very fast-paced development as well. And right. when people see the magnitude of the tools we're going to get this summer into the package, they realize how fast this product will go.
There's been a feeling among many flame artists that Autodesk hasn't brought out exciting new image processing innovations in the last several years. In fairness, multi-res and clip history were two of the top feature requests and pulls we did on the site. You got the master keyer and such, so there certainly have been some major changes in the software. With that being said, it was really nice to see some of the optical flow and image processing stuff during Martin's technology demo at NAB. Did Discrete put this kind of research on the back burner for the last several years?
No, I think there is, as you notice, the products has undergone over the past couple of years some major adjustment to rejuvenate them, I would say, whether it's multi-resolution, clip history, open access, and as you know, the arrival of a support of some configuration on Linux, that has clearly taken a lot of our time. The overall infrastructure, the underlying XML infrastructure, the ability to have the Flame small cluster and even Toxic start work on shared media and exchange timeline in XML or data structures in XML. We needed to do this investment. It's ongoing. We're not scaling it down. But I think what we find ourselves having more resources available now, we never stopped doing it, but now we can afford to do it even more now that we've digested some major technological investment. We had two different teams before between Toxic and Flame, and with all the work we've done internally, I think we have put those teams together, and that creates more critical mass. So now it will be a more productive environment, and you'll see more tools coming out of this common team between Toxic and Flame, and actually Combustion as well. So that was a smart move. It took a lot of time to get to there internally and to align the tools, but we're there, and you can expect now to see Flame, Toxic, and even Combustion move in lockstep and at hopefully a higher pace. We've been also hiring a bunch of people, and it shows too. So.
User group demo of Luster showed some really interesting technology with the 3D scenery lighting. Now, that's a tool as colorists haven't been exposed to before.
And what was interesting at NAB is a feature works when you don't have to explain it. You just show it, and then there is some sort of a blank because you say, oh, okay, I get it. And it was one of those moments, and it was very interesting. If you remember the old demo of Radio City inside Toxic, I mean, this is along the same vein, that when you have a lot more color depth or a more physically accurate representation of color, you can actually get yourself in the world of some simulations. So the regions mapping, relighting in Luster is really a message that we wanted to send out there. The barrier to entry in color correction is very low. I mean, doing basic color correction, we've seen people doing it. And really what we wanted to say is real-time color correction was the big deal 2 years ago. And so we've added all the tricks of the trade, like the tricks of the trade, like tracking and the garbage. All those technology of the VFX world is now pouring into the world of color grading. And we wanted to signal that the next step is about using a lot more science and getting more into the understanding the way lights interact with pictures and simulating more of that. So that's why we did this 3D relighting demo in Luster, because we believe that is the place that will differentiate our tools moving forward, and there is a lot of potential for innovation there.
There's been talk on Flame News recently about the current release of Flame having more bugs than in the past. Now, this discussion seems to come up every several years, but what is being done to address the concerns of these artists that the software is more unstable?
We've, as I mentioned, we've been rocking the boat pretty heavily over the past 2 years by doing some major surgeries. Like, you renovate a building by apartment. So I think we could always pay more attention to stability, and I think we're reaching a point now where we've done all the major work that we wanted to do, and we can focus a lot of our attention on polishing. So it's not so much stability, because we believe from our tracking that we're doing okay, and when we work with the support team, I think we believe that a lot of instability was also coming from operating the systems to the limit of the memory. And then, you can take any machine, and when you operate close to the limit, it's you can generate a lot of instability. And it's true that clip history was a dramatic change in the architecture of the product, and so was multi-res. So that's why we've decided to, you know, now that those big things have been laid out, really focus on polishing them. And we have 64-bit systems now, so the memory issue is resolved, and so we can take time. It's more also from the feedback we get from a workflow perspective. You know, the system's losing a bit of its consistency, so we decide that instead of doing another, getting into another next big revolution into the package, it's time to take a moment to look back on those changes, see how we can, you know, fully harmonize them, iron out workflow bugs and annoyances, as well as, you know, increase the stability now that, again, as I said, those big revolutions have happened. So we want to do that. More generally, I mean, each release is a cocktail of infrastructure work, of application workflow, features, and platform support. So we're in a pretty mature market, so we usually decide at a very high level from a business perspective. You know, we spend, probably some of you have experienced the PowerPoint torture. In our Whisper Suite, you think you come to see nice features, but in fact, you come to respond to tons and tons of questions, which is really the data that we look to set some of these themes. And then we put this data in the hands of our product designers, now known to be famous, Martin and Stéphane, and they really drive the fine tuning of what features make it to each release, and also what attention, what bugs should we pay attention on. So we've dramatically picked up the pace of releases as well. I mean, we're averaging two releases a year. We've aligned our business model to support that, so that, you know, minor releases are free for people on support, and we have this new subscription program so that people can, you know, get on the bus with us and for a flat fee get all the major releases. So a lot of work went into picking up the pace, delivering consistent value, and now, you know, we can adjust the mix of a release differently. Now, as I said, we've digested the big architectural changes, so a lot more can go to new tools, and a lot more can go to stability. And I think that's what you see. And we hear that from people. We understand you guys build your business and spend a lot of hours in a day in front of the system. So annoyances, which could be in other industries perceived as annoyances, can turn into being major problems for us. So that's where we are, and we're very happy that we can focus our attention on that. So,
switching gears a bit, it's fair to say that 3ds Max really hasn't gained the kind of foothold or reputation the effects and post-market that Maya has. And while it's incredibly strong in the gaming market, it just hasn't seemed to catch on. What do you think needs to happen for Max to make real inroads into the market?
Well, there are two answers to this question. The first answer is perception is reality, as we all know. And it was probably true a couple of years ago, or maybe 3-4 years ago, that Max at the time did not have the tool set needed in this environment, and so was discarded, and that is still the case. I mean, we see some very entrenched players, and, you know, the art is still, and the good thing about this industry, it's dominating by the artist, and if the people who make the difference think that better off with that package gets selected. And now we're many, many years of this process, and we see a lot of entrenched competition. The other thing is that there are, if you look at the evolution of Max over the years, now I think we're getting to a level where we're at parity with the competition. It was probably not true a couple of years ago, especially for this market. But we've started to add, you know, effects like Particle. That was like 2 years ago. The Manor integration, the Character Studio acquisition and integration to get on par with nonlinear animation, and you know, the rigging toolset. A lot of effort that were only made last year in Max 7. So there is a definite professionalization now, I would say, of the toolset of Max, and we architect it as a superset of the needs of everything we know. It's very interesting to see how slowly the gamers, in terms of their requirements, have taken the lead. I would even argue in scene complexity, they tackle some of the most complex visual effects scenes now. It's amazing to see what they do with the package. So, and when it comes to having hero characters and sophisticated rigging And at the same time, having to deal with mass amount of character animation, I mean, we see the game industry having those two requirements. So that's why we've kept our ear very close to the ground in the game industry, and we really hope that in doing so, we've developed, especially for the upcoming version of 3DS Max, which is not announced yet, but we have now a pattern in 3DS Max delivery that's easy to read. We've done a lot of investment in character animation, in rigging, in non-linear animation, and we've got toxic connectivity as well coming up to play, which would really make a difference for the movie market, and the OpenEXR support and a bunch of features. And I think as of very soon we'll be left with a perception issue, but I think people start to see through it. I mean, we had John Knoll in his articles, the promotion following up on a recent movie, acknowledged the use of 3DS Max and some of their rendering solution, Mentor and V-Ray, to do 3D matte painting in film. I mean, we see that quite a lot, because in those places in the movie studios, you get people that they know what the product can do. They had prior exposure and prior experience with it, and they know how productive that is. I think we've pretty much established, and when it comes to modeling and rendering a highly complex environment, Max is the way to go. And I think we'll be soon hopefully establishing ourselves in the character animation area. So that's our challenge moving forward.
3D fits in nicely as a product in the pre-visualization market, and it seems as though that area is rapidly expanding right now. Does Autodesk have any interest in that area?
That's definitely part of what we're actively working on. And actually, we're following our users. I mean, a lot of our historical users that used to spend nights behind the stylus are now spend their days in pre-production meetings and on location making sure that what gets captured can be used in post-production. And we see a deficit of tools for those people. And so we've been learning, whether it's in the commercial side of the world, Ripomatics, and how do you pitch the commercial, and how come you cannot use the quality you get on the first Xbox? We see our kids play with Xboxes, and they interact with 3D content and characters in real time, and you cannot build an agency pitch with such tools, and as well as in the movie, improvisation for movies. And it all starts with a metadata story, and it makes sense that if you can leverage or confidence check your data in the post-process. So it's the example of Luster on the laptop is one of these directions. Is okay, I can start developing ideas on a PowerBook somewhere at some point in the process, but this is only very valuable because I can upload the grading data so that it can get supplied to the scan, and I can double check, just like you have offline and online, and you can compare an initial quick time with your finished product. Having a strong underlying metadata story was the first element for us to get into this business. We're getting there with a bunch of initiatives that we're starting to disclose around Wiretap, which is a fully XML based environment, and around the toxic database. So on top of that, now we believe we can start to come with tool sets that can be taken on set and start laying out either creative ideas or really design tools, hence the Macintosh platform, which is the favorite for the designers, or just like you're on location, you say, let people know it's good enough for post. So we have ideas on how to reshape our technology to go into those domains.
You mentioned the Macintosh platform. Apple announced a changeover to Intel processors for the computers. What's your reaction to this move?
It really impacts our thinking so far, because that Intel announcement, I mean, there are two ways to look at it. There are some very operational reasons for Apple to do this move, because they're not a volume player, so either apparently IBM, it's public now that IBM and Freescale don't want to fund the R&D work for Apple, which Intel was about to do. So it could be just a margin dollar move from Apple, but I don't believe it. I think there is more to it, and we need to do a lot of guesswork with Apple. It's a very secretive company, one of the few very secretive companies on the market. But when we look at it, Intel processors, NVIDIA graphics, an OS with almost a Linux kernel. So it could mean lots of graphics power, lots of bandwidth, lots of CPU power, and a very sleek software environment. So that could change a lot of things for our industry. And so we're looking very closely at it and trying to guess what it is. The Apple environment usually was challenging both from a performance perspective and both also from a business model perspective. It's a highly controlled ecosystem, so it could be different. We're certainly very attentive.
And does a switch to the Intel processors make things easier from an engineering or programming standpoint? I mean, not that you're announcing anything right now about your products, but does a move like this make things easier for you to release software across different platforms? I mean, from a technical standpoint?
No, I mean, really at the level when we write software, we do some CPU level optimization. Like in product like Lustre, we have a lot of SSE2 optimization. But really what matters is the operating system. And we try to have dependencies on select sets of API, like OpenGL, which is an obvious interesting API for us, as well as POSIX, some OS, some layers that are POSIX compliant. So we try to not be too dependent on something that's very OS specific. That's all, our UI is very specific, and so we try to limit ourselves so that, we can port easily application from one platform to the next. But so the Intel announcement is not so much important because it's an Intel CPU, because it may signal a change of directions, which, as I said, put in the bigger picture what we know about the hardware evolution and all the GPU acceleration could be very relevant for this industry. Now there is the whole notion about there are so many iPods out there and how do you attach to them to sell more hardware, which would be less relevant for our industry, but we see the commitment of Apple to this market. So,
well, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. Thanks.